Let's do this.
Boom.
Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that's an architect, not a surgeon. My name is Corey Hazelhurst, and my parliamentary propagandist, Steve Haynes.
Hello, Corey.
We are also joined for the second time in this series by Councillor Bridget Jones. Hello, Bridget.
Hello, Corey.
Now, the comment about architects and surgeons will hopefully make sense by the end of this episode. This third series of Not Enough Champagne has all been about personal responsibility. We're looking at the personal responsibility of head teachers this week. We're looking at research on the types of head teachers that there are in British schools. Which types of heads are successful, which aren't, you'll find out after this very, very jaunty theme tune. All of this research comes from a Harvard Business Review article that was published a few years ago. They looked at the head teachers of 411 head teachers in academies, and the five types they found. The first type was a surgeon. Now, surgeons tended to be a PE or an RE teacher, and they were tough, they were disciplined. It was all about short-term gain. They would boost exam scores by removing poor performing students, often they'd exclude them from school.
Exactly as you would expect from the PE teacher, not so much the RE teacher.
I was wondering about this.
That tends to be the background of where they're studied, but I think, say you've got 411 schools, and there's a little bit of the fallacy of small numbers, where it might seem like there's a disproportionate amount of PE and RE teachers. Don't know how true that is.
Trying to imagine combining the two.
To be fair, I did actually have a PE and RE teacher at school. Both, so.
Religious football?
That would have been entertaining.
You could have a really religious sportsman. I mean, David Shepherd played cricket for England in the 60s. He was Bishop of Liverpool. So he could be an archetype surgeon.
Yeah, and instead of making kids pick their sport teams, you could just divide the kids up into Catholics versus Protestants and get them to play football. What could go wrong?
Glasgow. So surgeons, it's all about boosting exam results in the short term. They put their best teachers into the later years, so it tends to be year 11. They lower class sizes, and they put more time into revision classes. For the 1 or 2 years that those surgeons are at the school, exam results go up quite dramatically for the 1 or 2 years that they're there. Then it falls away. Often after it leaves, you know, these surgeons tend to be ones who go into a school, turn it around quickly. But because the early years are neglected, so in the secondary school, they focus on year 10 and 11 and not year 7, 8 and 9. It's tend to be those years that then, in a few years after when the head teacher leaves, then you see performance drop. And actually, a few years after the surgeons left, the school's in a worse state than it was before they took control. So that's surgeons. The second one, they're called soldiers in this review. Now, they tend to be IT and chemistry teachers.
IT and chemistry, that's a more logical grouping, I suppose. Chemistry is so specific, though. Where do the physics teachers go?
They just didn't become head teachers. They just love physics so much, I'm guessing. They just want to spend all their time doing physics.
I mean, to be fair, that does fit most of the description of all of my physics teachers at school.
Also, the massive physics teacher shortage. They're probably just not allowed to become head teachers.
Yeah, wouldn't shock me.
Now, soldiers, they're all about cutting costs. It's all about being disciplined on that, which meant that in these schools, the finance was good, but the exam results tended to stay the same. Also, morale in the school completely dropped because staff had very little job security. And the cuts that the soldiers made were too deep to sustain. So after the soldier leaves, the costs increase again because more staff are brought on to try and fill the void that's there.
I can see a parallel with national government coming.
What subject do you think accountants tended to teach?
Ooh, math seems like a too easy. That sounds like the klaxon's going to go off.
No. This isn't QI. If a year
there's no depth to our general knowledge.
For a year of not if not enough champagne has taught us anything, so the easy answer is always the correct answer. So, maths teachers, they're called accountants because these head teachers tend to look for new revenue streams. So if it's a secondary school, they might take over a primary school to get a bit more cash. Or they might try and hire the school out to have for conferences and that kind of thing, leisure facilities. Now, the revenue stream went up in these schools, but the exam results, they stayed the same. So that's accountants. Philosophers tended to be English teachers or tended to be language teachers. They tended to be really interested in teaching. these philosophers. Often their parents were teachers. They're really passionate about teaching. There's a big focus on teaching methods in these schools and talking to teachers about the right way to go about it. A really big change in ethos that way. Nothing changes in this school. There's no real evidence that exam scores go up or down in these schools. And a lot of that is because the culture doesn't change. The behaviour in these schools tends to still be quite bad because there's no focus on that. So teachers spend their time managing behaviour rather than teaching, which hampers the progress that's made in those schools. The fifth type of head teacher, they're called the architects. I'm very proud to say, as a history graduate, that these tend to do history degrees or economics. So history, economics teachers. And these tended to work in industry
now
first.
Now I understand why you picked this study.
Obviously. It's cherry picking. The other studies said that physics teachers were better, but that's just fake news. So these tended to work in industry first, maybe for 10 or 15 years before. And it's all about creating the right environment. Because they studied history and economics and not, you know, useless STEM subjects, they know how societies... They know how societies are created, they know how societies are shaped.
It's all right, so, we know how universes are created.
Yeah, that's less useful.
Creating the right environment tended to be through things like putting in a sixth form so that there were career opportunities for older students. Maybe it was creating a relationship with the primary school so that you can pool resources and expertise in those fields. It could also be improving student behaviour by finding pathways for students who suffer from behaviour. Also, it tended to be improving teaching by introducing coaching programmes or mentoring programmes. Also, a lot of focus on extracurricular things like school trips to boost students learning that way. Schools led by architects, they were the most successful. Although it took 2 or 3 years to lead to improvements, these improvements tended to be bigger than in other schools, and they also tended to be more long-lasting. So after an architect had left the school, the improvements still carried on years after they'd left, unlike surgeons, say, where these performances would drop off. So, of those five different types, who do you think get the most recognition and who gets the least recognition?
Well, I'm very much hoping that your most effective architects are getting the recognition, and not just because you're staring at me, Corey. But I've got a horrible feeling it's not that.
I was going to say, my guess is that it's probably going to be the ones that don't make much of an impact at all, either one way or another. It's going to be
the flash in the pan people.
Well, no, I was going to say like the philosophers who come in because they're the ones that really value their colleagues, and therefore they're the sorts of people who would get recommended for lots of things.
Oh no, my money's on the first type, the quick boost in exam results, bugger off, collect your paycheck, and let it all come crashing down after you've left. That's where my money is.
Well, actually, you're both right, which is nice and yet terrible for our education system. So, philosophers tend to be the most frequently appointed, as you alluded to, Steve. So, out of the 411 heads, 161 of those were classed as philosophers. And they tended to get the biggest number of honours. So 30% of those heads, they tended to have an MBE or a CBE or a knighthood. But these were the worst performing schools, both in terms of kind of cost per pupil, but also in terms of development and exam grades and what have you.
Gives new meaning to the various services to education.
And also to Philosopher King, I think. Plato's Republic in action. Or inaction. Surgeons tended to be the ones most honoured in terms of the number of people who had CBEs and MBEs and knighthoods. But the schools that they, as we said, those after the surgeon leaves the school, the performance drops off and the school has long-term problems. And the Harvard Business Review article says that on average in those schools, $2 million, so I'm guessing that's about £1.5 million, that's £1.5 million paid to consultants to sort out the problems in those schools after the surgeon leaves. And the architects, as you say, they're unnoticed. And partly they're noticed because they tend to be outsiders. They tend to have worked outside education before coming in. One philosopher head teacher that the Harvard Business Review interviewed for the article, they said, well, you can't run a school unless you've taught for 20 years. Now, what this article demonstrates is that...
That's not true.
It's not true.
Yeah, I mean, this is something which I find quite interesting about the way we approach education, and I don't think it's just here in the UK. I think this is actually a wider trend, certainly in the US as well. We seem to assume that the job of a head teacher is very similar to the job of a teacher. In reality, they're not. The job of a head teacher is perhaps more similar to a chairman or a CEO or someone in charge of a department of a business, rather than someone who just has to stand in front of and educate the kids. And those are very, very different skill sets. You will have some people who've got both, but broadly speaking, the people who've got one skill set are not necessarily going to have the ability from the get-go to do all the other things. And I think that's probably where we're kind of falling down with how we're choosing our head teachers and therefore our education system. We bump up a good teacher to become a deputy head or a head teacher, and then we just go, there you go. Even though they've not necessarily got the required skill set to run that school effectively.
Yeah, LJ talked about that in the Meritocracy podcast, which we had earlier in the year, I think, about teachers being outside the classroom. Reminds me of the debate around football managers as well. I think before people like Jose Mourinho and Arsene Wenger, there was this feeling that you had to be a great footballer to be a great football manager. And I think what people like Jose Mourinho prove is that you don't have to have played football
at all
to be a good manager.
That's a weird thing I found in my job, actually. So I am neither a trained teacher nor a trained social worker, and I have to lead a massive workforce of teachers and social workers. And when I first started, I was quite acutely aware of the potential credibility gap there and needing to win the respect of people who had done this for years and years. Actually, what I found is it is such a different job to what they're doing, and my day-to-day is so, so far removed from what people have to do on the ground. In terms of the type of thing I have to do rather than the issues, it actually doesn't make a huge difference.
It's very much kind of the same kind of issue that arises whenever you look at like government departments and you go, clearly the person who's the Secretary of State for Health should be a doctor or a nurse or whatever, or clearly the person who runs the Department for Education should be a teacher. It's like, not necessarily. Yes, it's good to have a grounding and a knowledge and an understanding of those things, but I'd rather, to be quite honest, you had the business admin guy or the business intelligence guy from the NHS running the Department for Health than a doctor, because the doctor's only got one very narrow viewpoint, whilst the business intelligence guys had to look at the entire system.
It depends how you go about your job as well, because someone, say, like Michael Gove, he hadn't been a teacher, but unlike yourself...
Are we allowed to swear on this podcast?
Well, yeah, so unlike yourself, Michael Gove just talked a lot...
He did it again.
Michael Gove just talked a lot of bollocks about stuff he didn't know much about, which is not something that you tended to do when you were in children's services.
Gove was crazy. He took pride in the fact that he'd rewritten the English history curriculum himself. He's not qualified to do that. He's a politician who used to be a journalist, but he took pride in the idea that he'd meddled in stuff that professionals really ought to be doing on the front line. I made a decision very early on that I was never going to do anything like that and stick to my area and trust professionals to get on with the things that are within their purview and within their skill set, within a framework that that I set.
Yeah, but if there's one thing we've learned is that we've had enough of experts.
And that's interesting with the philosophers, I suppose, isn't it? Is that it's those teachers that talk about teaching and can talk a good game. It tends to be those type of head teachers, even though they were in the worst performing schools, they tended to be put on curriculum bodies to look at teaching, to review teaching, to improve school performance. It was those that tended to be looked at as opposed to architects, probably because architects weren't that showy. It's quite unflashy, it goes unnoticed. Philosophers were always talking a good game about teaching.
Yeah, I think with most things in life, there's always, when you're looking at who's effective and who's not, there's always a class of people who look like they're doing a good job, but in reality, it's all just bluster. Doesn't matter whether you're looking at public sector or private sector, doesn't matter what kind of vertical you're working in, those people are always there. And those people are almost always the ones which seem to get the most attention, because the people who are actually slogging away, doing the hard work and actually making the difference are too busy, for the most part, actually cracking on with it and go, because rather than going, oh, I've got a really busy day, but I could make half an hour to go give this talk on something about this style of teaching, they're kind of going, I've got half an hour, I'll get on with this and look at how I can implement this, rather than trying to put themselves forward.
Is there a way, do you think, of trying to get better head teachers into schools? Because I think the thing that the Harvard Business Review article is not quite good at is showing how you get these people into schools. One of the things it says, it's about changing the way that we, the statistics we use to judge schools, so we can look at the impact of head teachers. So rather than looking at the percentage of students with an A to C pass rate or the spend of money per student, which is what we use at the moment to judge a school, instead maybe we look at the numbers of students with 5 A to C passes, not the percentage, or you look at the amount of budget surplus that we've got. But that seems troubling as well, because we've got different school numbers, so that doesn't really work. And also, if you start looking at budget surpluses, that might even...
That would benefit the accountants,
yeah.
And arguably even the soldiers, considering their cost-cutting measures, but that doesn't necessarily push the architects up to the fore, because again, they're busy actually dealing with the systems and the structures, which are a long-term game. They're busy putting those in place rather than trying to make a quick win.
And would also massively disadvantage primary leaders. So there's definitely a difference in parity of esteem between primary leaders and secondary leaders. Secondary is the space that people tend to go to if they're looking for glory, new flashy free schools and so on, whereas all the evidence shows the earlier you are, obviously the more difference you are making, which actually is the same story as we're, or the same lesson as we're learning from the study, isn't it? So this appears to be the moral of the day.
Are there any things that we can look at, or any measurements we can take to try and judge a school's performance we can look at instead?
I think, to be quite honest, we're probably almost there from my perspective in a lot of ways. I mean, looking at it as a percentage, the number of people who get the number of kids who get the requisite A to C grades, maybe with a bit more focus on the core subjects. I don't necessarily know what things are like under like the current educational regime, but certainly when I was doing my GCSEs, my school was focused on getting everybody those A to C's, but those A to C's were also coming in the form of some BTECs and things like that, which were not as arduous as the GCSEs that I was doing. And they were throwing kids onto these courses because they knew it would be easier for them to get the grade, and therefore their results would look better. Now, incidentally, my school also failed its Ofsted inspection that very year whilst I was doing my GCSEs. So, lesson to be learned there, potentially. But there are certainly, at least there used to be, room for kind of a bit more of a focus on, for lack of a better term, more academic skills. Like, it doesn't necessarily need to be A to C in English, Maths and Science, but it needs to be you have this level of ability with mathematics, this level of ability in literacy. If you're focusing on those things and the improvement that certain kids are able to show as well, because not every person is going to be able to get up to that equivalent C level in everything.
Well, actually, they're trying to look at improvement now by looking at Progress 8. I think the problem with, without wishing to completely derail the podcast with another detailed explanation of Progress 8, what it basically does is look at how you did in the end of Key Stage 2 in Year 6, and then you look at how they do in Year 11. You then take that and look at what the average child with those results has done. Say you got level 4s in the SAT. God, why am I doing this? So if you got what you would expect someone to get, your Progress 8 score is 0. Mm-hmm. If it's below what you'd expect, it's negative. If it's ahead, then it's positive, broadly speaking. But I think there's a couple of problems with that. One of them is that assumes a uniform progress through life, which isn't how it works. You know, a lot happens between the ages of 11 and 16, and as we know, the past performance is not really a guarantee of future progress, and that's as true in education as it is in anything else. I think the other problem with looking at Progress 8 is that it depends where you are on the bell curve of the year, and it assumes there's always going to be a bell curve. You could have the same results, you could have the same progress, but if you happen to be born in a particularly bright year, you'll have a negative Progress 8 score. If you happen to be born in a particularly stupid year, you'll have a positive Progress 8 score. And that's the problem with it, is it just completely changes.
I mean, for me, I'd say the issue there is just grading it on a bell curve.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be grading it on a bell curve in comparison to the rest of the school. It should be based on the individual student.
Yeah, but that's how we grade SATs now. Key Stage 2 SATs are graded on a bell curve. So if you get the average of the whole year, your score's 100, I think. And then your scores, you either get more than 100 or less than 100, depending on where you are on the bell curve. which is a silly way of doing it, really.
So a big problem in Birmingham is pupil mobility. We have one school where I don't think a single child who finished in year six had started their own reception last year. And I visited one last week where roughly a third of kids will turn over in that primary school in between reception and year six. It's somewhere like, big cities in particular do suffer from that. And it makes it very, very difficult to get any meaningful data. But there's also an interesting question as to, are GCSE results the right thing to be measuring and progress against those? If you look at the university sector, we tend to measure the university sector not by how many people get a first or a 2-1, which would be very difficult anyway, given every university sets its own marking criteria. And it varies massively between subjects within universities anyway, but that's a whole other issue. But we don't measure them by that. We tend to measure it by employability afterwards and how many people have gone and got jobs. I wonder, actually, if we're missing the point slightly in school results. It would be much harder to measure because kids take longer to enter the job market. But the ultimate outcome for the kid is whether they're a happy, independent, employed adult. And I'm not aware of any studies that have done that kind of longitudinal work and tracking that back to what happened at school.
That would be interesting. You could do a where are they now a few months afterwards, because we said one of the good things for architects is to put in a sixth form, and that would be a nice incentive to put in, say, post 16 education for those pupils.
Longitudinal studies of any sort, I think, with this, you're probably going to get into a couple of areas which are just going to be massively problematic to actually ever do it. If you're talking GCSEs, say, and you're checking them after that, well, everybody's still got to be in education after that point. You're either an apprenticeship or you're doing your A-levels.
And that's the problem with what I'm proposing.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing you could focus on maybe is the amount of exclusions, because as we've said, surgeons tend to exclude a lot of year 11 students before their exams, but then
if you're excluding people, then it implies that there's actually a systematic error somewhere in your school, because you've not actually got a control on behavior.
That could be one way, perhaps. One thing that an architect head mentioned in the article is that they want to be judged by how many parental complaints there are at the school, or how many ASBOs are issued in the local community.
Quite interesting.
So that could be a more holistic view, maybe.
Or the mental well-being of pupils afterwards, actually. And how confident and happy they are in themselves by the time they leave.
So you mentioned universities before, some sort of national student survey, kind of happiness survey. Happiness survey of teenagers, actually. I'm not sure how good an idea that is.
It sounds like straight out of the Cameron playbook.
Yeah, we've gone David Cameron. Whoops.
No one ever wants to do that.
Full Cameron.
The other interesting stat in the article, which I quite like, is that if architects were 50% of school leaders in the UK, because if you've got a more educated population, that tends to lead to an increase in GDP, UK GDP would increase to between about $3.8 and $7.6 billion, which is interesting, isn't it? It feels like a very academic conversation to have, and yet it has such a massive impact.
Didn't you say in the last podcast that we needed to raise a similar amount to make our public spending sustainable?
Well, I think it would be 75-80 billion, yeah. Depending, so that would be 10% of it. You mean we don't just have to cut, we could do some...
Yeah, we could invest.
Increase productivity.
Save,
yeah. That area we've been lacking in as an economy for decades. Madness. We've talked a lot about the metrics and kind of how you can therefore encourage kind of like the focusing on these architects and things like that. But I think the core thing is going to be, it's not going to matter what they're being measured on unless you've actually got those architects in the schools themselves. And as you said before, it looks like a load of these people are coming into teaching later on in life after being involved in something else. The real question to my mind is, how do you encourage those people that are going to have got the right mindset for this sort of stuff to then get involved in teaching? Because you ask, if you were to turn around to anybody, even like a successful CEO, somebody who'd run their own business and sold it and was now kind of just sat around not doing very much, if you were to go up to them and say, have you considered ever becoming a head teacher, they'd go, no, why would I ever do that, I'm not a teacher.
But the reason why people go into, these architects go in after being in private industry tends to be because they want to give something back, or they tend to want to affect social change. that tends to be why they come back in. So maybe it just depends on the kind of businessman you're asking.
But here's the thing. Relying on the good graces of certain sections of society isn't really sufficient to ensure that we have a top-class education system. We need to find a way that you can actually encourage people from all over to get involved and say that this is a valid career progression for you. And that is something that I think is very, very lacking at the moment. Weirdly, although maybe it's not necessarily working to the extent that it could do, shifting to things like academies with the various trusts and things behind them could, in theory, open up the door to more of those sorts of things. Again, when you look at some of those trusts, a number of them are run by people like Paul Marshall, who's a hedge fund manager, trying to get involved and give back to the community. And broadly speaking, I believe he runs a string of very successful successful schools. I mean, they may not be all be outstanding, but I don't think any of them are bad. Overall, you need to find a way to get those sorts of people involved in becoming head teachers and not just kind of governors, in effect, which is what an awful lot of them are. They are currently.
But again, is that part of improving the image of teaching?
Yeah, fundamentally, the way to solve your recruitment crisis in all levels of education is to treat your teachers better. To ease the insane workload on them and the massive, massive pressure culture. Fundamentally, until you fix that, you're not going to get people queuing up to do the job. Or stop the massive hemorrhaging of teachers, Corey.
Yeah, guilty. I am a statistic now. I don't count as an individual in and of myself. Our theme tune is Plucky Good Times by Dave Depper. It's from freemusicarchive.org. Our logo is designed by James Cramp. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cramp. You can follow me at Paperback Writer.
I'm at Centre Radical.
And I'm at Bridget Jones.
We'll be back next Sunday. Speak to you then. Bye-bye.